From the Sky News Centre at 6, David Cameron's reiterated his pledge that the UK will take in more asylum seekers as the migrant crisis deepens. Thousands of refugees in camps on the Syrian border are expected to be allowed into Britain. The Prime Minister's also made another commitment on aid.
Today I can announce that we'll provide a further £100 million, taking our total contribution to over £1 billion. That is the UK's largest ever response to a humanitarian crisis.
Meanwhile, hundreds of refugees are walking from Budapest towards the Hungarian border tonight, having given up reaching Western Europe by train. It's been confirmed cancer patients in England will no longer have access to 16 medicines via a special fund from November. The NHS has slashed the number of treatments available through the Cancer Drugs Fund, saying they're too expensive. Deborah Lancaster's from pharmaceutical firm Roche, which makes breast cancer treatment Kadcyla, one of those taken off the list. She insists this isn't the end of the matter.
We're talking to NHS England. We have proactively given them cost reductions over the last 2 or 3 years. We're not giving up. We're continuing to talk, but we've got to find something that suits both parties.
An initial report has found the vintage plane which crashed during the Shoreham Air Show last month appears to have been in good working order. 11 people died when the Hawker Hunter came down on top of slow-moving cars on the A27 in West Sussex. A fine of more than £1 million has been handed to Hugo Boss over the death of a small boy at one of its stores. Austin Harrison, who was 4, was crushed by a mirror which fell on top of him at the Bicester Village outlet in Oxfordshire in 2013. 4 men have admitted conspiring to burgle the Hatton Garden Safe Deposit Company in central London over Easter. £10 million worth of valuables were stolen in the raid. And in football, Scotland are 1-0 down going into the second half of their Euro 2016 qualifier in Georgia. Elsewhere, Northern Ireland can go top of their group with a victory in the Faroe Islands later. That's the latest. I'm Tom Harrigan.
You analyse what radio is. What is it? We don't make anything. We produce programmes, but you can take it or leave it.
That's right.
We don't change the world. So I admire these people that do, in their daily work, create a motor car, help the sick. But what am I doing? I'm sitting in front of a piece of machinery like now and talking down a wire, which comes out in somebody's house. Hopefully I don't, but the media and people within it put themselves on pedestals.
They do
tend
to.
And they've got no right to.
No.
But you are a friend, and that's the way I always look at it.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The second highest number of executions in the world, Iran is seen by some as a barbarous regime. One Iranian charity alleges 17,000 Iranians have been killed in terrorist attacks since their 1979 revolution. So is Iran really a terrorist state, as the West, or many in the West anyway, have been saying? So does the recent nuclear deal and the partial lifting, at the beginning of it anyway, of sanctions mean that Iran may now begin to join NATO in the fight against ISIS? The British Embassy just this last week has opened in Tehran for the first time. After my trip to Tehran this week, we look at President Rouhani's rehabilitation by the West. And also joining me in the studio is Iranian-born Bristol member of the UK Iranian Society, Mehrnaz Shahabi. Plus, You Stink in Lebanon, the peaceful rubbish collection protest that's been transforming itself into a militant, secular, violent protest. We hear from Beirut-based investigative journalist Andrei Vulcek, who's been talking direct to the demonstrators. With ISIS lurking close by, he's been looking into their role too in destabilising Lebanon. Plus, from last week, the one airliner that was allowed to leave otherwise closed US airspace on the afternoon of the 9/11 attacks. Who was on it and where was it heading? We hear from the author of Solving 9/11, Chris Bolin. And Martin Summers gets his chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. we begin with a look at Iran. I'm pleased to welcome from the UK Iranian Society, Mehnaz Shahabi, to the studio. Hi, Mehnaz. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello. Thank you very much.
First of all, this, I would imagine, is making you quite happy, the rapprochement with Iran, the opening of the embassy and the signing of a nuclear deal. Is that the case?
I think that it is a positive step for Iran and for peace. I'm very pleased that the sanctions, illegal and illegitimate sanctions on Iran, will be removed. And I am looking forward to a situation of relative normalization in Iran after years and years of active chronic threat of war and sanctions, which have also impacted very negatively on on democracy and human rights in Iran and the lives of Iranian people. I think that the nuclear deal, insofar as the sanctions are removed and normalization, and also recognition of Iran's right to nuclear enrichment, which was very important, it is positive. But I want to mention something about it. I think when commentators and analysts and politicians talk about this deal being a positive step towards peace, they are talking about the threat of nuclear weapons, Iran having nuclear weapons being removed. And the possibility of an attack on Iran. This is actually a lie, because according to the US intelligence agencies, since 2007, Iran was not making nuclear weapons. And it also stated, since 2007 and years subsequent to that, that Iran never had any, hasn't got any intention of embarking on making nuclear weapons. So the way that it's presented to the public is actually distortion and lies.
One of the things I remember was that the agency, the nuclear agency, was actually handed so-called evidence about Iran's nuclear weapons program, which was actually manufactured by the Israeli intelligence service, the Mossad.
Absolutely, yes. And in fact, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because one of the negative aspects of the deal that quite a lot of Iranians are worried about are, for example, the snapback sanctions and mechanisms of snapback sanctions, according to which if there is a suspicion about something in Iran, some sort of something that Iran shouldn't be doing, and it doesn't reach a resolution with the IAEA, then that goes through a commission. If it doesn't reach a resolution, I think within 24 days, it goes to the Security Council, and the sanctions can be, United Nations sanctions can be put back on Iran again. And we know that Israel and the United States are very capable and have been manufacturing false flag operations and lying about Iran's nuclear program and manufacturing, fabricating evidence. And I think they are very capable of doing that in future.
On another level, they're very different societies, British society and Iranian society. One of the things I noticed when I was over there earlier this week was the amazing... it seems that the whole thing of personal integrity is more valued over in Iran. I went in, for example, into a bank to try and change some money from pounds into the Iranian currency. I went into this bank and the guy didn't know me from Adam. He said, well, actually, yes, you can change your money here, but if you go down the road, you can get it changed at a much better rate. So why don't you go down there? And this sort of, I was quite amazed that someone would put the making money out of me so low down their priorities. They seem to think, well, I'm just going to be honest with you. And I was really impressed with a lot of the sort of culture. But anyway, for, as someone that's been in both, spent a lot of time in both countries, may I ask, well, what's your impression of the difference between the British culture and that in Persia, Iran?
Well, I think that Iran has been demonized so much in the past, I don't know, since the revolution really, but particularly in the past sort of 15 or so years, that I'm not surprised that you see some sort of nice, honest interaction in Iran, and it surprises you because of the degree of demonization.
Well, what it surprised me was it's different to Britain. I think if you went into a bank in Britain and tried to change some money, they wouldn't say if you go to the bank next door, you'll get a better rate. They'd take a, you know, take your money and run, wouldn't they?
Maybe yes, maybe no. I think that both societies have their good people and bad, dishonest people. But I think that perhaps people in Iran are sort of less formal, and it's something, so it's a cultural difference.
Yes, it definitely, I would say less formal, definitely. It's a little bit rough around the edges, Iran. Maybe if you know, I think my impression was beneath the surface, people are more genuine, maybe, but on the outside, things aren't necessarily all clean and tidy. I suppose you'd expect that in a country that's been through a revolution. But anyway, getting down to talk more about what we're here to talk about, what about the embassy? What does that actually mean for you and cultural exchange, travel, that sort of thing? Is it important that the embassy has opened in London, the Iranian embassy in London and the British embassy in Tehran?
Oh, absolutely. I am pleased that the embassies are open. Firstly, it makes it much easier for the Iranian community here and their spouses and children to go back and forth to Iran. And the cultural contact, I think that it normalizes the situation and reduces the false impressions and distortions and demonization of Iran. It is very interesting because that really shows in 2010, I think it was, Craig Murray, the ex-ambassador to Uzbekistan.
Well, he's a great blogger, isn't he? Yeah.
That's right, yes. He exposed meetings between Adam Werity, Israeli lobbyist, William Gold, who was British ambassador to Israel, and Liam Fox, who was the then defense minister. They had meetings with Israeli Mossad.
Well, he's our local MP, isn't he? North Somerset.
Yes, that's right, that's right. And the focus on that was to create the to make sure that Britain could assist making an environment for war with Iran. And it is very interesting that soon after that, the embassy closed. Of course, the closure of the embassy was an overreaction, because it came immediately after Britain had announced draconian sanctions on Iran's central bank with the idea of hurting the Iranian population. So that was a reaction. And although Iran apologized, the embassies were closed. And now, something very interesting in relation to that was that the U.S. congressional report of October 2011 actually refers to this. That they say that it is, the report says that the aim should be to cut diplomatic relations between European governments and Iran, air flights between Iran and European countries, closure of embassies, and going alongside European sanctions and isolating Iran. So the opening of the embassy now, it's very important in that regard, because it was as part of that dynamics of isolation of Iran and agenda for war.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, this is a very old culture, isn't it? Even the Romans didn't manage to conquer Persia. I know that Napoleon was trying to use Persian horsemen as part of his campaign. It really goes back a long way, but it's amazing really that Iran and Persia has managed to maintain their identity over so many centuries.
Well, they've always been a geopolitically very central place. They're very important today, as they've always been, a key piece on the jigsaw on the international go board, if you like.
I mean, if we're looking at this is what I mentioned earlier, which was the Israelis falsifying information about the Israeli intelligence services falsifying information about the Iranian nuclear program, then handing that to the IAEA. I mean, it does imply that the Israelis have really got it in for the Iranians.
For any objective view, there is no evidence whatsoever that the Iranians have been trying to develop nuclear weapons. There's simply none. The Ayatollah Khomeini himself said we're not interested in nuclear weapons.
But I mean,
there is a fatwa against production, and of course that's quite rational from their point of view.
Can I just say something here? Because the British Magnox nuclear power station, when we started nuclear power, one of the main drivers of it was so we could get enriched uranium and plutonium to make nuclear weapons.
Yes, and of course there is a big question mark over whether a nuclear power is actually a viable in a free market economy. So that you say, well, if you're going to have nuclear power, but you're going to develop nuclear weapons. But I think there are things about prestige of having nuclear power, which is to do with, you know, if you're allowed to have nuclear power, why aren't we allowed to have it? And also, of course, it makes sense for the Iranians to diversify out of oil. It sounds silly because they're sitting on an oil field. But on the other hand, you don't want to spend your whole life being a supplier of basic commodities to the rest of the world. You want to be able to have a diversified economy.
Now,
under the non-proliferation treaty, the Iranians are absolutely entitled to develop non-military nuclear power. There's no doubt about it.
Now, Menas, I was pretty shocked actually when I went over there to be shown evidence. I mean, I've yet to have actually a copy of the PDF, but some evidence that this charity's got that 17,000 people in Iran have been victims of terrorist attacks since the revolution. Not least of which, I think it was in 1981, the entire government was blown up in a terrorist attack. Just tell us about this, because this is something we're told over here that Iran, the mad mullahs, if you want, are the great sponsors of terrorism. Yeah. But actually, the reality on the ground seems to be the opposite, which is really frustrating, that there are actually 17,000 people in Iran have been killed in terrorist attacks against the country.
Well, Iran, as a punishment for the 1979 revolution and becoming an independent country, has really been the victim of state-sponsored terrorism by the West, mainly from the United States and Israel. Now, in 1981, I mean, the hypocrisy here is something to take note of, that the Iranian cabinet was... there was an explosion, a bomb explosion, and an Iranian cabinet was murdered. Someone called Kolahi, who was a member of the Mujahideen Khalq, was identified. He escaped to France and was never extradited. Now, MKO had been killing
American... So this terrorist is just walking the streets of
absolutely,
France?
Absolutely, absolutely. And in June, Mujahideen, MEK, killed the Iranian prime minister at the time, and Bahonar, and the president, Rajai. And the Europeans and America, of course, the MEK was for many years recognized as a terrorist organization. But then I think it was in 2009 that it was removed in Europe from the list of Europe's terrorist organisation and later in the United States.
Martin,
so the hypocrisy is amazing.
Martin, it's an incredible toll of people, politicians, nuclear scientists, ordinary people caught up in these blasts, 17,000 people too have been killed. What's at the heart of this? Why is the West and Israel so... fearful of the Israeli regime? Why do they hate them to such an extent that they need to run such a massive terror campaign inside Iran, killing so many Iranians?
Well, as Minaz pointed out, it's revenge for the revolution in 1979. Before 1979, the Shah was the gendarme of the Middle East for the Western powers.
And the Island of Stability, it was called.
Yes. So they, at that stage, I mean, and of course, the Mossadegh regime, which was a moderate nationalist regime, which came to power through democratic elections in the 1950s, and they wanted to nationalise the British oil interests.
That's right.
And the British got the Americans involved in overthrowing that government and imposing the Shah of Iran, which who was eventually overthrown by the locals in 1979. Mm. And you don't have to completely agree with the direction the revolution took after that to see that that was going to happen in the end, and it did happen in the end. Mm. And of course, Britain and the United States were responsible for ending democracy in Iran in the 1950s. Mm. And that is just a fact which every Iranian child will know from their mother's knee. And they've been demonised since then for all kinds of reasons, because basically they won't do what the West wants. They won't. They've tried to develop their own way of doing things, which many other countries would like to do but can't. And they've resisted the sanctions for all these years, which has caused great hardship to the people in Iran. And of course, the West uses sanctions against democratic countries like Russia, like Iran, to make the ordinary people scream, so that they then eventually, hopefully, will overthrow their regimes. Mm. And of course, the sanctions aren't directed at the regime, they're directed at the people, and they hope that the misery of the people will lead to them turning against the current rulers. And that hasn't worked in Iran, and it's not working in Russia. It wouldn't work in Britain. If people tried to do it to the British, they would respond in exactly the same way, and they'd say, we're not, precisely because you were putting sanctions on us to try and change our government, that's precisely why we're not going to change it.
Mm. Yes, I mean, as part of this 17,000 victims of terrorism in Iran conducted by the West, I mean, there are, as Martin mentioned, Iranian nuclear scientists, and great numbers of Iran's military personnel, citizens, and revolutionary guards that have been killed. And the West has been, through its covert operations, actually assisting terrorist groups inside Iran and fomenting separatist groups, terrorist groups conducting terrorist activities. In fact, Seymour Hersh wrote an article for New York in 2007 referring to that there was a presidential finding in 2010 that George Bush asked for $400 million to conduct covert operations in Iran. And of course, you can imagine that the impact of that on Iran's internal situation, the state of fear and terror and democracy and human rights in Iran.
One thing I did notice was Facebook is censored there, and Twitter, which I found a little bit... I must admit, I think this is totally counterproductive. I found most of the young people I spoke to had downloaded onto their smartphones a little American app, probably an NSA app, which enables them to get around this anyway.
Yes.
You know, so what they're doing, it does seem to me, I'm really interested to hear your view on this, Menez, is there are some of the policies of the government, particularly to do with trying to control behaviour in things like Facebook, are actually building up a problem for the future, because a lot of young people see the government as too authoritarian. In a few years, well, they're young people now, but in a few years' time, this anti-government, internal government sentiment, pro-Facebook, pro-Hollywood, if you want, sentiment, may come back to haunt them. I wonder what you think.
Well, I mean, in an ideal situation, of course, one would want the Twitter and Facebook and all these websites to be freed, but you can't look at this in isolation. We know that there is a context to that. Where is Facebook coming from? Where is Twitter coming from? What functions do they have?
But I mean, just one example. For example, yeah. I went round to one of the museums. We were at this conference. I wanted to tweet some photographs of what was going on to other people, you know, and wasn't able to. We weren't even able to take cameras into the conference, so we couldn't take pictures, and we couldn't, as journalists and academics from all around the world. Actually, we were pretty much from every continent there. We couldn't do that, and it's quite a restriction, it seems to me, that might be a problem in the future. So, what's the reasoning behind it, do you think?
Well, I mean, as you say, you notice that people download things and they can access Twitter and Facebook and all those other things. And in fact, they do. Many, many Iranians are on Facebook and on Twitter. But let's not forget that Facebook and Twitter have been instrumental in color revolutions in Eastern European countries and in the Arab Spring.
So there is this
fear of that.
Yeah, of course.
In fact, I wanted to mention something about, there is a guy called Michael Einstadt, who is the senior fellow and the director of the Washington Institute for Military and Security Studies. Now, in 2010, he says that an untapped source for the U.S. operations against Iran is using a communication campaign and changing the psychological environment in Iran through this communication campaign. So you can and create the circumstances to make Iranian government paranoid.
Well,
you can see how they are playing.
They seem to
this
have
game.
Succeeded at that, you know.
Anyway,
one of the main things going on in that part of the world, of course, and everyone is talking about, is the amazing growth over the last year of this Islamic State, Daesh, they call it a lot over there. Mm. We tend to call it ISIL or ISIS over here. And when I was over at the conference, I spoke to a Russian journalist. He's actually based in Beirut, and his name's Andrei Vilchek. And this protest in Lebanon, where he lives, is called You Stink. And so I asked him about, this is basically over rubbish, but there's been mass protests there, which he says he thinks have been infiltrated. And also ISIS regionally is really destabilising Lebanon. So I asked him about what his thoughts were on all that, and also what would happen if Lebanon falls, because the government is getting, it seems, increasingly fragile.
I'm Andrei Vilchek. I'm a novelist, philosopher, investigative journalist, and filmmaker. I'm based in Japan and in the Middle East. And 2 days ago, actually, I spent one full week covering events in Lebanon since the very beginning of the uprising. The movement is called You Stink. You Stink because of the garbage collection that collapsed in Beirut. It collapsed mainly because there was a protracted crisis with the garbage dumping. It was 18 years old, actually, a saga when the government ran out of garbage dumps, and it convinced two small villages that the garbage should be dumped in their area. And from the short-term solution, it became a drama when people were getting sick, they began dying from cancer, nothing was done. One thing you have to understand is Lebanon is one of the most capitalist countries on earth. There is nothing social. There is no social garbage collection or recycling. Everything is privatized. There is no public transportation. Only 35% of children go to the elementary schools that are government owned. The rest goes to the private schools.
So are you saying that they literally ran out of landfill? There was nowhere to put the rubbish that was being collected?
Well, it was actually even worse. What happened is that people began dying from cancer and other illnesses, respiratory problems, and they blocked the site. And they said, halas, enough, we are not going to allow this anymore. And garbage began piling up on the streets of Beirut. The city administration was using rat poison, the white powder. We were all carrying it on our tires, so people were getting even sicker. Add pollution to this, blackouts, water shortages all over Lebanon, and you have a scenario. So people went to the street, they began protesting, and they were demanding actually fundamental changes in the way how the country is being governed. At the very beginning, You Stink movement was very well organized, and it was very legitimate because people really didn't want to have sectarian country anymore. The slogans were very lofty and very impressive. It was, we don't want to be Christians, we don't want to be Muslims, we want to be Lebanese.
So this slogan from the You Stink movement just came out of the blue from this movement that was about rubbish and garbage, suddenly into something to do with sectarianism.
Well, it's, in Lebanon it's always much more complicated because people do realize that the country sucks. There are no social services. There is no government. There is no actually president for more than a year. The parliament had to meet 20 times, and they couldn't agree on the president because of the sectarianism. So protesters put together garbage crisis, utility problems, education, health, with dysfunctional government, and they connected it to the sectarianism. So that was the beginning. It was first day, fantastic. Second day, you began to see people appearing on the street, stripped from waist up, throwing metal bars at the police and at the army. And police and the army overreacted. They began using rubber bullets. They were shooting water cannons. That didn't go very well with the families from Beirut who came there, actually, with the little babies and the original protesters. They thought they are going to have a dialogue, and they were met by rubber bullets. People were injured. To the extended report on the second day was that 400 people were injured, which was probably exaggerated, but still, at least more than 100 people were taken away by ambulances or treated at the site. They are a peaceful group of people. They want to get million. I was told we want to get 1 million people so the government resigns and we can have new elections. But they were totally opposed to the violence. Now, talking to the protesters, everybody was pointing fingers at each other. There is no doubt, and there was no doubt from the second day, that there was infiltration. Now, the question is, who was infiltrating whom? The prime minister is closely associated to Hezbollah. Of course, those who are against Hezbollah were accusing him of sending people. His group of people, protesters who were supportive of the government, were accusing others. So it was very difficult to be sure what's going on. But what I encountered was that before these demonstrations, I was told by my very good friend that she met a Lebanese young man. She talked to him very seriously. He was unemployed, and he said, look, I'm getting funding from a European Union NGO, which is actually paying me for destabilizing Lebanon. And we were all laughing because it was 3 days before the protests. But then it was not funny anymore. And he sent to her an SMS on the second day. He said, they are shooting at me. Meaning what? He's there, right? He's at the protest site. Now, I talked to two diplomats in Beirut, and of course they didn't want to be named, but they said that they encountered and their staff encountered a very bizarre British man who didn't speak Arabic, but he was there fighting alongside the protesters. So there were all sorts of accusations flying back and forth. Now, Lebanon is always full of speculations. There are horrible scenarios that were predicted that could happen, that the West, which doesn't like Hezbollah is fighting ISIL, Daesh in the north of the country. ISIL wants to establish the caliphate close to Tripoli, so it would have access to the sea. So one of the theories was that if there is a huge protest going on in the center of Beirut, the Lebanese army would have to interfere, meaning withdraw from the fighting with Daesh, and Hezbollah would probably also have to go to Beirut, and that would create the vacuum. That means that Daesh could take over the north, and then speculations were going on and on that Israel would get involved in all this. But Israel, of course, is threatening to invade Lebanon periodically. So you never know exactly what is going on, but the threats and dangers are definitely there.
Okay, political instability, lack of proper president, government, to what extent is that naturally occurring inside Lebanon through kind of backbiting, infighting, or do you think that's being influenced from outside?
Lebanon, it's a bizarre economic structure. Is partially to blame, and that comes from outside. Also, ideologically, it's a place that you could hardly find anywhere else in the world. It was a kind of ideological bastion of the West, because the American university is there. As I was told by one of the professors there, almost every dictator, almost every ruler from the Gulf is educated there. And he added, and those who didn't get educated there are dreaming about getting educated there. So that's one thing. So ideologically, this is a stronghold of the US and the UK. Second thing, during the destabilization of Arab Springs, the workshops that the West was running to indoctrinate the young kids who were going back to Egypt and elsewhere were held in Lebanon, in Beirut. So this is very dangerous, because obviously my conclusions that I wrote for RT, for Counterpunch, for Telesur, is that most likely the original protests were genuine, but it is extremely difficult for genuine protesters to maintain their purity of the movement. You know, that at some point they will be infiltrated in the country like Lebanon, where there is such a huge presence.
ISIS is a bit of an enigma. Who's really in charge?
I was investigating it in the cities of Hatay in Turkey, where the refugee camps were served as training camps by NATO, by Turkey, and by US. Turkey is a NATO country, of course. RAF base in Adana, and which is also used by the United States Air Force and Turkish Air Force, was allegedly also used for that, and so were the camps in northern Jordan. So the West is behind it, according to most of the analysts in the Middle East. And from my investigation, yes, I have to confirm that I believe that the West was involved. Now, Hezbollah, which is the only social force in Lebanon and the only force which is willing to go across the sectarian lines, because they also incorporate Christians, Hezbollah is locked in a dogfight, an epic battle with ISIS. They already lost more people than they lost during the Israel, fighting Israelis during the Israeli invasion. So right now, Hezbollah is the only force that can stop ISIL, because the Lebanese army is dysfunctional. It's torn and it's receiving funding from left and right, and training from left and right. The recent supply of arms came from France, but it was paid by Saudi Arabia. Personnel of the Lebanese army is trained in the West, in the European Union and in the United States. So it's not really trustworthy force. So Hezbollah is the only force that can stop and is stopping so far ISIL or Daesh. And Hezbollah is closely affiliated or closely linked to Iran. So obviously the West is definitely not happy about A, the link, B, that it's a social movement, and C, most likely that it's fighting Daesh. ISIL is a very complex organization. I was 6-7 miles from Mosul in November with the Kurdish battalion commander, and even there, going there from Erbil, I couldn't grasp really what is happening inside. Although I interviewed people on the phone from the Kurdish people who had relatives in Mosul, it was very difficult. But what I can say is that the entire conflict is propelled by the West, because the 6-7 miles from Mosul, the situation was such that Daesh bombed the bridges, they took over the city. ISIL was trained, supported by the West. The second force was a Kurdish army, and those people, the battalion commander was telling me that he was trained for 6 years in UK and for 1 year in the United States openly, and that all his men were trained. And so third force was involved in bombing of the villages, a total disaster at this border, so-called border, and that was the US Air Force. And they actually, you know, so you had three forces directly linked to the West, so I don't really know how to interpret it in other words than actually the West is fighting itself, or it's playing war games. So we were there on the destroyed bridge, and ISIL or Daesh were a few kilometers away. They saw us. I mean, there was a Kurdish command, and there was me, foreigner, and there were land cruisers of the Kurdish military. And they were shooting some mortars all around, you know, but not near to us. And I didn't feel unsafe. I felt that there was some sort of the deal made between the Kurdish forces that were supposed to liquidate them or fight them, and Daesh and the US.
You know what, it almost sounds like theatre.
It was, that's how it felt. But the real victims, and I have photos of this, and I published it all over the world, were the villagers, because these villages were totally ruined. I mean, they were hit by the smart bombs, by drones and all this. And then I asked the commanders of the Kurdish force, and I said, look, how many people died there? And they began swearing to God that nobody was killed. I said, I mean, I know what I can identify when the village is razed. So it's totally Kafkaesque situation in former Iraq. You wouldn't believe over there. It's not only Daesh. There is also total destitute in the Kurdish part of Iraq, which is promoted by the West as a success story. I saw people, villagers, and I photographed them picking up the roots on the main square to cook something to eat because they had no food next to the oil refineries and Turkish road tankers that were taking oil out of that area. It was absolutely unbelievable. I talked to the people who had houses overlooking oil refineries, and that's not only like 10 kilometers or 15 from the line with Daesh. Right? And I was talking to the local people, and they said they got no compensation from land grab by the oil refineries. I talked to the school teacher who said that there was absolutely nothing that was going to the education from all this oil. So it's absolutely Kafkaesque situation. And then you have refugee camps. But refugee camps for whom? For Syrians. You know, not for people from Mosul, but for Syrians. And I talked to them too, close to Erbil. People told me that refugees are actually screened, that they have to say that they are against Assad, otherwise they would be sent back, and they are interviewed. So I confirmed and reconfirmed this, and this is the case. So the entire Iraq is ruined. And then I was in Erbil, one of the oldest citadels in the world. Erbil is one of the longest inhabited cities in the world. And I was talking to the old scientist from Iraq, whose university was destroyed just 2 weeks earlier by Daesh. And he was crying. He was sitting there. He was showing me on his smartphone all the photos of his students. And he said, my university is no more. And basically, the West destroyed my country. There is nothing anymore. He said, all this Daesh, it was created by the West. And they ruined my country. And I'm a refugee now in my own land. And I'm a former scientist. So from Lebanon to Syria to Iraq, there is almost no Middle East anymore. It's a disaster. And so if Lebanon now falls, probably it's going to be another horrific catastrophe, because it is not only Lebanon as such. There are 2 million Syrian refugees in this tiny country at this moment. So imagine what would happen if Lebanon would fall. So by no means it should be allowed to fall.
That's Andrei Vilcek, investigative journalist there, speaking to me in Tehran, actually, earlier this week. Martin Summers, one of the poignant things he said there is that the whole of the Middle East seems to be collapsing, effectively. That's what he's saying. Iraq absolutely had it. Syria going downhill fast, and Lebanon maybe following suit.
Well, yes, it's extremely distressing and upsetting situation. And it's having all sorts of ripple effects on even in poor old Blighty, where people are getting upset about refugees might turn upon their doorstep.
What about his point, though, about these three forces that he encountered in Iraq near Mosul, where you've got ISIS, who he's saying were originally, anyway, propelled and armed by the West through the supporting the Libyan uprising, armed uprising, and the so-called moderate rebels in Syria. Then you've got the Kurdish force, these guys saying they were trained here in Britain, probably at Sandhurst. And then the third force being the US Air Force, who's then bombing the villages. Well, it sounds like theatre. He says war games.
Well, it is a theatre. ISIS or Daesh or whatever you want to call it is very much a creation of Western intelligence services and the Saudis. I don't think there's any doubt about that in the Middle East. All serious people know that that's the case, which is, it's very frustrating when the media in Britain, for example, continuously holds them up as a terrible bogeyman that we've all got to hate, without pointing out that in actual fact they were trained by our own special forces in places like Jordan and Turkey. And as I said, said in the first hour, Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister under Sarkozy, went on television in France a couple of years ago. He said, when I was a foreign minister, I was approached by British officials before the Arab Spring who said to me, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Do you want to participate? Mm. So for all British people listening, the mess in Syria was deliberately created by our government, not even the Americans. The Americans led from behind and left the British to organise the actual detail. And that is just a fact. And at the same time, we're being told that we've now got to lose our civil liberties and people are not allowed to express their opinions because they're all being radicalised by ISIS. But ISIS is being trained by SAS. And that's just a fact. And most people in Lebanon will know these facts.
Well, he mentioned,
but people
he?
In Bristol may not. This is why we have
he
our
mentioned
programme,
that ISIS. He mentioned that ISIS were being trained in Turkey and Jordan.
Indeed, and Turkey and Jordan are our allies, and it's quite certain that British military personnel will have been involved in these. They certainly were involved in Libya. The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group were unable to remove Gaddafi, even with air support. So British and French special forces were taken in to make sure that the job was done. And in fact, the links between the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, Daesh, and also and Al-Qaeda go back a very long way. In the 1980s, the Mujahideen in Afghanistan were trained to take down aeroplanes in Scotland by the British SAS. And this is all, you know, the history is now coming back to bite us in the bum, as it were. And it's not just that it's the consequences of the history, the facts of the history can't be denied, and even recent history.
Yes, in fact, what you're saying is confirmed by the document which was released in May under the pressure from the law firm Judicial Watch, the Pentagon document, Defense Intelligence Analysis, of August 2012, in which it actually explicitly says that the interested parties, which was the West and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait Gulf countries and Turkey, were wanting to get rid of Bashar Assad. And from the start, the extremist groups, Al-Nusra, Al-Qaeda, Salafis, and Muslim Brotherhood, were actually the main constituency of the Syrian opposition. And the report says that that was known almost right from the start, or at least as early as 2012. And the idea was that it was predicted that the Salafist principality would come out of these forces, and it will bring down Bashar Assad and weaken Iran, and also Al-Qaeda will emerge from Iraq, and an Islamic State would be formed, which will be a threat to Bashar Assad and weaken Iran. And of course, although they could predict what is going to happen in terms of mayhem in the region and the bloodshed in Iraq and in Syria, the West actually did not stop that policy. And Michael Flynn, who was the former head of the Defense Intelligence in the United States, actually confirms that in his interview with Mehdi Hassan, that this was a willful decision of the United States to allow ISIS to form, to carry out these imperial agenda.
Amazing, really. But if we go back a couple of years, Martin, we had this Ghouta chemical weapons attack in the Indeed. Summer, didn't we, in Damascus? So what about all that? I mean, because that was an attempt to initiate an attack on Syria by the West.
Well, it did, and Ed Miliband, bless his cotton socks, dug his heels in Parliament and refused to get the Labour Party to vote for war on Syria on the back of this atrocity. Mm. And of course, Seymour Hirsch, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He wrote the very important article, the redirection,
yes,
about how, and of course, embedded in that article was a detailed analysis crisis and what happened at Ghouta. What he suggested was that it was actually Libyan sarin, which had been looted by Libyan Islamic Fighting Group from Gaddafi's stockpiles. It was taken into Syria via Turkey. It was used by al-Nusra Front to kill local civilians, and then it was going to be blamed on Assad, and then we were all going to go to war with Syria to get rid of Assad. And in actual fact, the evidence points exactly the opposite. It was the rebels who used the sarin, and they got the sarin from the Western security forces, and I'm quite sure that MI6 knew all about it.
Okay, let's go back a couple of years now to US Marine veteran Ken O'Keefe to see what he had to say about all this on the Iranian channel Press TV.
The United States has never been interested in anything other than war. The United States is in a perpetual state of war because the bankers control the politicians and they read the script as given to them by the banksters and they make huge amounts of money off of this. What this gentleman is saying about the United States not wanting war, not wanting to get involved is like Iraq 2.0. It's a repeat of the same rubbish that was said, oh, we don't want war, you know, war is a last resort. That's absolutely untrue, it's a lie. Those that are in government are nothing more than prostitutes who are carrying out the orders of those who are in charge of them, and those that are in charge want another war. And part of that is what we discussed earlier, the Greater Israel Project, to destabilize any Arab regime which might have any kind of autonomy and self-determination. Any regime in the Arab world that is not an absolute puppet cannot be tolerated. And who are the nations that we target? Those that are not puppets. We don't target those like the Saudi regime, which is the biggest human rights violator in that region. It's cutting off people's heads in public, cutting off hands. It is the most grotesque regime on the planet, and yet we give that regime weapons, and it's no problem whatsoever. The duplicity and hypocrisy of the United States and the West can't even be measured. It is so enormous. And these mouthpieces, such as this gentleman in Washington, is only doing a disservice to himself and his country. And the fact is that American sons and daughters will get involved in this yet again, and these chicken hawks who are pretending to care about the Syrian people are going to be sacrificing not their own sons and daughters. I would like this man to send his sons and daughters and his grandchildren off to Syria when this turns into a greater conflict, because this is what we're flirting with, is a world war, a third world war. This is not a joke. We are flirting with a third world war on the basis that apparently we care so much about the Syrian people, just like we care so much about the Iraqi people and the Afghani people. The only people that buy this sort of stuff are either bought off prostitutes or the dumbest of the dumb. And we're also led to believe that Assad is the dumbest idiot dictator on the planet now, isn't he? Because he invited UN inspectors to come in, and he brought them in on the very day that they come in. He decides to attack his own people 10 miles away from where the inspectors arrive. This is beyond ridiculous. And the only people that buy this, again, are bought off prostitutes or the dumbest of the dumb.
They don't intend for limited strikes, and that's not going to do anything. They want to go in full scale. That's the plan. Of course, they'll use pretext to be able to justify the initial attack, and then they'll concoct more things to justify a greater involvement. The Daily Mail reported here in the UK, and it's commonly understood to those who are paying attention, that defense contractors, leaked emails from defense contractors, proved that there was already an approved plan from Obama down to give these psychopath terrorists, al-Nusra Front, chemical weapons. We know that al-Nusra Front, 12 individuals in Turkey were caught with 2 kilos of sarin gas. Where did they get that from? And this is, you know, clearly a false flag. We understand this to be true, and it's the only way that they could justify an attack at all. And I have to say, I'm happy that the gentleman in Washington mentioned Dempsey, General Dempsey of the Joint Chiefs, because I'll tell you what, more than anything else, it is the true American patriots, those who are sick and tired of having given up their life to basically serve the American dream, the American nation, the Constitution that they swore to uphold. It's those military men and women. It's you now. It's coming to you now. Are you a patriot or are you not? Are you going to let your nation descend even further into the chaos and corruption that has been so sick and so twisted that it's destroying American lives as well as the rest of the world, to the tune of 22 American servicemen a day who are committing suicide? Are you going to sacrifice more of your American sons and daughters for Israeli wars, for Zionist wars? Are you going to continue to do that? Because you are not a patriot. You are, in fact, aiding and abetting the terrorists you suppose supposedly think you're fighting against. And those Americans who are waking up to this, I hope to God, in the military in particular, that you refuse your orders. And this is why the people of America who are refusing to buy this nonsense, the overwhelming majority do not support any kind of attack on Syria. And in those in the military, I know that the powers that be are very, very frightened that high ups within the military will refuse the orders. And I hope this is exactly what happens if an attack on Syria occurs.
That was a former US Marine, Ken O'Keefe, there speaking on the Iranian channel, Press TV. Now, Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford Economist, why don't we hear Ken O'Keefe ever on Newsnight? Because he puts a pretty strong case there. He's saying, hang on a minute, guys, this is World War III we're facing here, potentially.
Well, because the one of the mechanisms of psychological warfare is to control the narrative. It's all about control of the narrative.
Mm.
So, for example, we haven't heard, as I mentioned earlier, the million people that have fled from the East Ukraine to Russia. Have we heard anything about them and the problems they've got and when they're trying to settle down in Russia, with the Russian government having to find new houses for them and all the rest of it? No, we haven't.
Or millions of refugees, Iraqi and Afghanis in Iran.
Or anything that's been going on in Yemen, where they couldn't be clearer. The Saudi military and the UAE have invaded Yemen. They've sent tanks over the border into a foreign country, which they don't control, completely against all of the UN Charter, completely against everything. But you won't see anything on Newsnight about this. Nobody's, Kirsty Walk isn't reporting, although we're still being bombarded with stuff about Syria. They haven't given up on the idea of getting us to fight about Syria. They may even try and turn this refugee crisis into, oh well, we've got, the only way to stop the refugee crisis is if we go into Syria and get rid of Assad.
Yeah.
That's what they're going to
but
try
you
and
can't
play.
Start
it's controlling the narrative.
You can't start a world war just based on controlling the BBC.
No, but controlling the BBC and controlling the narrative is very much part of what goes on. So, for example, the aggression by the right wing in Ukraine I was on Russian TV earlier this week. The right wing in Ukraine attacked the parliament building and killed a police officer with a grenade. You won't have heard anything about that on the BBC, even though, in actual fact, it definitely took place, and it's the sort of thing that we ought to hear about. But we didn't hear about it because it's not important. It's not important that there is a news management going on continuously. But of course, in this modern era that we live in, the Iranian government can't control what people listen to and read, and nor can the British government ultimately, and nor can anybody. The truth will out in the end.
Mayonnaise, what about what? I mean, you can pick up on anything that Ken O'Keefe had to say there, but what about, I'm asking particularly about this whole idea of the Greater Israel Project, because what he's suggesting there is what Martin's called, I think it's the Yinon plan, Martin, that
yes,
you talked about.
That's right.
Which is to destabilize countries so that Israel can expand.
Yinon plan, who was a journalist and worked with Israeli Foreign Ministry in 1982, proposed this Yinon plan, according to which he argued that Israel's survival will only be guaranteed if it's the sole supreme hegemon in the region. And as part of which, the Arab countries and Iran, they needed to be broken up and balkanized into small, weak statelets that would be controlled, sort of satellites of Israel, and it also morally legitimized Israel as a because the division would be along sectarian and ethnic lines. So it would sort of morally legitimize Israel, and it would render them weak. So it is really about breaking up the region and render it weak, and Israel expansionism.
I'll ask you both finally, very, very quickly, please. What do you think is the best solution? Martin, you first.
Stop making war.
Okay, pretty simple. Menas?
Well, I think that the best solution, what comes to my mind now, is that in the light of Iran having signed this deal, which has been over a manufactured crisis of Iran nuclear weapons program, Israel should be demanded to join the NPT and open its nuclear facilities to inspection and disarm.
It's nuclear secrets. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock. Our sister show, Dialect, is on here Tuesdays at noon, where this week we hear about George Bush's role in the 9/11 attacks, and a Monday arts project for September at the Kabeli Centre in Easton. Thanks to our guest you just heard there, Mayonnaise Shahabi. Also, I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. You can find our stuff at thisweek.org.uk. Don't let the banksters get you down.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.